Apostate Fieri had always known this day would come. The chairman sat behind his desk, and on the desk lay the knife, the ancient, black-bladed knife, the hilt to the chairman's left.
Apostate, you have been a good and faithful servant.
Sir.
You have been long in our service.
Sir.
You are the blade I trust. We have an enemy time will not wound for us.
Sir.
You are my blade, Hostite.
To the heart, Chairman.
To the heart, Hostite. Without prejudice.
A kill. A kill beyond the borders, but only one. For that he was glad. That only one kill would burden his soul in eternity.
Come near, and I will aim my blade.
He was already dead, though he walked. Coming near could not increase his mortality. Hostite waited, and the chairman said nothing for long moments.
It is a grave thing to order the death of one who has never been under your authority. I give this order reluctantly, Hostite. Not only for what it means to you and to me, but for what it means to the peoples, the clients. But there is no other way. The man is swollen with ambition and would force on us all his ungodly ways.
They are heathens, sir.
Not all like this, Hostite. I bid you kill Hobart Consuline. None other of his family. Only him.
Hostite bowed.
The method, sir?
Your choice.
His last assignment. His death at the end. And the death of the chairman, who would no longer have his personal swordmaster, the shadow of the Master of Swords, to ward him from that danger. He felt the honor, and it warmed him. Death had not been a stranger to him for years, and nothing waited for him in age but someone's blade when he faltered. This he could do for his people and his faith, and he almost smiled thinking of it.
Go now.
Hostite withdrew, already thinking how he would do it. Hobart slung his clothes into the hamper.
Worse every day, those damned idiots.
He put on his fencing tights and began his exercises. When the door opened, he glanced up, expecting Iag and Perseus. But he had never seen this swordmaster. An older man, a bit stockier, in sleek black stretch, with a funny-looking red cap and red slippers. In his hands, he carried a sword unlike those Hobart used.
It is time.
Hobart straightened up and pushed past him into the saal.
All right. Where's that other swordmaster? I'm used to him.
He was indisposed, Lord Consuline, and asked me to take his place, that you might not be inconvenienced awaiting his recovery.
Hobart stared at the man.
You're certainly more formal than he was. What's that blade you've got? Do I have to work out with that? I suppose you want me to learn yet another stupid archaic weapon.
Not if you don't wish it. What weapon would you prefer?
Rapier.
Hobart looked around and realized that his coach wasn't there either. He would have to get his own gear, since he didn't think this old man would oblige him. But to his surprise, the swordmaster moved quickly to the racks and brought him a rapier. His favorite, he realized, and a mask.
You seem angry.
Hobart didn't want to talk about it. He came to exercise to forget, or at least ignore, his problems for a time.
I am.
Did someone ill-treat you?
Yes. But I'm here to fence.
Of course. My pardon, Lord Consuline. Swordmaster Iagan told me of your dedication, your seriousness.
He did?
Hobart had never been sure the swordmaster approved of him, though the man had always been courteous and respectful.
Yes. He said you were unusual, a man who took everything seriously.
Hobart adjusted the mask and bounced a little, loosening his knees. He had skimped on stretching. And if Iagan thought him serious, then he had better be serious.
That's true enough. Not many are... You would not believe... No, never mind.
But if you need to stretch out and ease your mind with talk, as your sinews with exercise, then you should, my lord.
Oh, very well.
Hobart laid his blade down on the mat, carefully, and leaned over to grasp his ankle.
I hope it doesn't bore you. And you must realize it's confidential.
Of course. You need to turn your wrist a little more, my lord.
It's these idiots, these dung-for-brains weaklings that I sponsored to high office. I made them what they are. I led them and taught them and groomed them for office, and now that they're in power, they simply will not do what they're told.
Ah, and now, my lord, another centimeter of pull. Yes. And now the other leg. Remembering to keep the wrist rotated in. Yes.
They are supposed to be my supporters, but do they support? No. They go off and do stupid things, like that idiot Origiemos.
And to the other side now, my lord?
Oh, it's enough to make a saint spew rocks!
Hobart found it amazing how easy the fellow was to talk to. The combination of the warm, quiet room and familiar scents of leather, steel, oil, sandalwood, cedar, and the quiet, patient, steady hands of the older man, molding him into one shape after another that stretched out knots he hadn't even realized he had.
It is difficult when subordinates are not obedient.
Exactly. I've tried reasoning, scolding, even threats.
And they resist.
They certainly do. If they only realized I'm trying to make things better.
Hostite had studied the files. He knew Hobart Consuline as well as anyone could, who had only files to go on. But the man in reality had shocked him. He was so miserable, so full of anger and fear and envy, that the whole room stank of it. His body had been stiffened and deformed by it. The very muscles of his face were saturated with his rage and fear. He was a skin bag of poison. He was immortal, being a rejuvenant, as the silver and cobalt rings in his ear boasted to the world. So old, and yet so full of folly, he had learned nothing, Hostite saw, in all those decades of renewed vigor that rejuvenation had given him.
Pride. My own pitfall. Yes, this man is proud and bitter and angry. But why?
Hostite had never yet killed without understanding why those he killed were as they were. He must offer the opportunity for understanding, for contrition, for repentance, though he could not offer, must not offer, any chance of escape. He must give the soul a chance, while giving the body none. All that Lord Consuline was saying could be considered a confession, but in a true confession, the sinner knew that what he confessed was sinful. Hobart didn't seem to grasp that at all. Hostite listened to all of it. Hobart's envy of everyone whose personality drew others. Envy of everyone, in fact, for he could always find something in which another had received unearned benefit. Pride, a towering pride, certainly of his own rightness, and the moral weakness of others. Anger at everyone, avarice, for nothing was ever enough, even for a day. Lust, and a wide streak of cruelty that enjoyed humiliating others. And all of it, every sordid detail, drenched in self-congratulation. A swordmaster must know when enough was enough, and Hostite had that moment of revelation. This man would not ever realize his errors, not even in the moment of death. Poor soul, so benighted, so hopeless of a better eternity, so ignorant. But God gave each soul enough in time, if it chose to use it. And Lord Consuline's soul had had the same chance, years in fact, to come to a better understanding. Finally, he stood back.
Come now, Lord Consuline. You are feeling better. It is time for your lesson.
Yes, I am feeling better.
Hobart clambered up, rapier in hand, in body a little straighter than he had been, his mind a little clearer in the aftermath of confessing, even so inadequately, his current crop of sins.
It is not your associates. It is you.
Hostite was sure Consuline would not understand, but he had to try. Lord Consuline's eyes widened as he saw the movement of the great dark blade, the backswing which promised such power.
What?
Your failure.
The blade swung forward. Lord Consuline tried to parry with the rapier, and the blade sliced it short, sweeping on. Consuline jumped back, mouth open to yell, and Hostite pursued, choosing to dance the figure rather than step it. His pursuit, and Consoline's fear used up the man's breath.
No! What are you doing? Help! Stop! Security!
Lord Consoline glanced from side to side, clearly frightened, and grabbed at another weapon off the rack.
I am your death. Your life is over.
Another swipe that parted a practice foil as if it had been a blade of dry grass.
Ask forgiveness from your god.
The man had none. But again, he must offer the chance.
I didn't do anything. It wasn't me.
The great blade took Lord Consoline's head off with one stroke, and the harsh stench of death overtook the sweet, spicy scent of cedar and sandalwood. The chairman of the board of the Benignity of the Compassionate Hand faced away from his desk, looking out the tall windows at the formal garden. A boisterous spring breeze whipped the tops of the cypresses, and even swirled stray petals from the early roses along the pebbled walks. From here, he could not see the fountains, but he could imagine the spray blowing out behind, a long, damp veil that would slick the marble rim of the cascade, the seats behind it where the old ladies sat in their black dresses on fine days, watching the sea and the children playing. He lifted his gaze to the horizon, to the blue sea, its glittering tessellations flinging the sun back in his eyes. He had had, on the whole, a successful life, and since he had just made his final confession, he was conscious of it as a whole. This and this he had done well, and that he had done less well. On occasion, the grace of the Almighty had protected him from the consequences of his own errors, and on other occasions he had taken the blame for what was not his fault. All this was to be expected, and he regretted none of it, for regrets were useless. It had been a life of human shape and human content, and he was glad of it. If regret had been part of his mental furniture, he might have regretted, he almost regretted, this last necessity. It was not his fault that the Familius Regnant had fallen into the hands of Hobart Consoline, and that he had been forced, he had seen no alternative, to order the man's execution. It would have taken supernatural ability to foresee all that had happened to bring Consoline to power, and to shape him into someone who could be so dangerous and offer so little maneuvering room to the Benignity, and no one expected supernatural ability of a chairman. Only that if he failed, he must pay the price. Those in the Benignity were in his power absolutely, but outside the Benignity, the rules changed. To compete, to convert, even to invade, that was allowable. To corrupt, and to have secret agents providing information and forwarding the interests of the Benignity, that was inevitable. But to call for the assassination of a foreign king, or whatever the foreigners called their heads of state, that was proof that a chairman had failed, had not seen trouble coming, had not managed affairs in another way, had not done, by means of stealth or influence or intimidation, what needed to be done. Still, no tool, no method was forbidden. God, in his wisdom, knew that emergencies happened. If, to protect the Benignity, a foreign king must die, then the chairman could so order, and so it would occur. So also would occur the death of that chairman, who had shown himself to lack the qualities of a chairman. Whether he was stupid, or old and tired, or misled by advisors did not matter. He had failed his people, and he must pay the price. Not unexpectedly, not cruelly, but surely and certainly, and with all due ceremony. No guards were in the room today. He had made his last confession, and his heart was as light and sunny as the spring breeze. When he heard the door, he turned. Some had chosen not to look, but he had never been afraid of the man who would kill him. Only of the man who would let him fail his people. The Master of Swords stood by his desk, formally dressed, and carrying the dark blade they did not use for fencing. The chairman did not meet his eyes. It was impolite to look into the eyes. It could be interpreted as pleading.
You know my reasons.
Yes.
I have made my confession.
The Master of Swords stepped to one side and raised his blade.
Yes.
The Master of Swords swung, and the blade that had taken the life of 16 chairmen sliced through skin and sinew and bone as easily as a hot knife through butter. Blood spurted, but blood was nothing new in this place, and the servants knew how to clean it up. The master wiped the blade with a square of scarlet silk and laid that silk over the chairman's head.
In nomine patrum, requiescat in pacem.
Then, as he was, naked blade in hand, with flecks of Pietro Alberto Rossa Votari's blood on his cloak, he strode out of the office, through the anteroom, where the secretary was now already calling for servants and would soon be notifying the family, down the hall and into the boardroom, where the board had been waiting for the chairman to appear and open the meeting.
The chairman has made his last confession.
Faces paled, but no one spoke.
The board will elect a new chairman.
Anxious looks back and forth, and at him. Some of these men had never been through the election of a chairman. Rosa Votari had held that office for 18 years. The swordmaster stood by the door with nothing more to say as they looked at him and away and back and away. It was nothing to him what they did, and nothing they said would he ever repeat. But they would not leave this room alive until one of them had been elected chairman by acclamation. The ship had been in downtransit only a couple of hours when the captain called Baron and Esme into his office.
I have messages from your families. They say they have more important things to worry about than you two. They're not happy with you, and they don't approve. But in the present emergency, they're not doing anything except talking about it. To each other.
To each other?
Yes. Admiral Serrano and General Suiza both signed this.
He handed over the hard copy.
Actually, all the Admiral Serrano and General Suiza. I don't know what you thought you'd accomplish by running off together, but you seem to have unified a substantial number of high-ranking officers in at least one thing. You're in trouble.
But we're married.
It's worth it.
It better be. Because when everything settles down, and there are no wars, mutinies, invasions, terrorist attacks, pirates, or other distractions, your families are going to come down on you like one planet hitting another.
This was, as May thought, a fairly accurate description of the probable interaction of Serrano's and Suiza's anyway, with the exception of themselves.
Now get out of here and go back to being the frustratingly competent officers you both are.
They did not scamper away in glee, because officers did not scamper.
When everything settles down, eh? That'll be the day.
If they wait that long.
Esme thought of her father and uncle talking to Baron's grandmother and great-uncle. If they didn't kill each other right off, and the combined message suggested they hadn't, that was a dangerous combination to have running around the universe.
They'll get used to it. We aren't half as bad as we could have been. Suppose I'd married Cassie.
Esme gave him a look. They hurried down the passage to their tiny, but adequate for the immediate purpose, cabin.
The Serrano Legacy, Change of Command, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Mort Shelby, Andy Clements, Elizabeth Demery, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Casey Platt, Tom Simpson, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Christopher Graybill, Jonathan Watkins, Lily Beacon, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Sonny Lasky, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Kate Foster, James Lewis, Tess Rowan, Ren Casey, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Ken Jackson, and Michael John Casey. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Change of Command, be sure to look for Rogue Angel, available at road stops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.